Hello and thanks for joining us for this WTTW News Special. I'm Brandis Friedman, and tonight we're focusing on local policing. Officials say a court-ordered study on how police officers are being deployed in Chicago is nearly complete. The latest on that and CPD's efforts to comply with the federal consent decree. Plus, how local law enforcement is responding to the ramped-up presence of federal agents in the city and the possibility of National Guard troops being deployed to Chicago's streets.
Becoming and remaining a sanctuary city has been a bit of a mayoral tug of war.
And amid ramped-up immigration enforcement, a look at how Chicago became a sanctuary city and what that actually means. And we'll get to our focus on police and policing in just a moment, but first off tonight, Indiana's governor is calling for a special session to redraw the state's congressional districts. In the latest national battle over redistricting, Republican Governor Mike Braun wants the state's lawmakers to convene a special session in an effort to redraw congressional boundaries in favor of Republicans. But Republican lawmakers in Indiana may not be sold on the plan, with some warning it could backfire politically. Democrats can't stop the special session by refusing to attend, as lawmakers in Texas had, because Republicans hold a supermajority in both chambers. The special session in Indiana would begin November 3rd. Democrats in Virginia are also considering redrawing districts. A tactical team of Chicago police officers have racked up more than 50 complaints about traffic stops and searches, according to a document obtained by WTTW News. The letter from the Civilian Office of Police Accountability, or COPA, is addressed to the commander of CPD's Near North Police District, which includes neighborhoods like Lincoln Park, River North, and Westtown. In it, COPA's chief of investigation says, quote, first, over 90% of the complaints that COPA examined involved the stop of black individuals, despite the fact that black residents comprise only 6% of the population of the 18th district. While COPA recognizes that some of these street stops and traffic stops may have been justified in their totality, the racial disparity in the stops may be indicative of implicit bias and/or racial profiling. The police department says four of the tactical team officers named in the letter have been stripped of their police powers. And to learn more about the legal impact of this letter, please visit our website. Candidates for public office were up early this morning filing petitions to snag the coveted first spot on the ballot in their respective races. And voters may see a lengthy ballot for the March 17th primary.
We have a very unique amount of interest in so many different positions. If you look at the ballot composition, whether they're filing in Springfield today, whether they're filing here, or whether they're filing in other counties, you have a number of U.S. Congress seats that are up, and you know, it's just going to draw a lot of attention. We've got a U.S. Senate race that's going to be highly contested.
In Springfield, candidates for statewide election like Congress and the governor's race lined up to submit the required petitions. And at the Cook County Clerk's Office, candidates submitted for races like president of the Cook County Board, as well as sheriff, treasurer, and other offices. Folks who submitted today will enter a lottery to be first on the ballot. The deadline for submissions is 5 p.m. November 3rd. After that, the age-old process of challenging petitions. Up next, the latest on how the Chicago Police Department is progressing on compliance with a federal reform order right after this.
WTTW News coverage of policing and police reform is supported by the Joyce Foundation.
Long-awaited study on whether Chicago police officers are efficiently and effectively deployed across the city to stop crime and respond to calls for help is nearly complete. It is part of Chicago's ongoing efforts to comply with the federal court order known as the consent decree that requires the Chicago Police Department to change the way it trains, supervises, and disciplines officers. Our Heather Chiron joins us now with the latest. So, Heather, when will we see the results of this study, which you've reported is very crucial to efforts to comply with the consent decree?
Well, it is set to be completed on time by the end of the year, and the public should be able to see the results by January at the latest. Now, city officials and police leaders are hopeful that this study is going to give them a roadmap to fulfill one of the central requirements of the consent decree, which requires officers to not only work with members of neighborhoods to fight and prevent crime, but also ensure that officers routinely patrol the same part of the city and report to the same supervisors on a consistent basis. That will go a long way towards fulfilling the hundreds of requirements of the consent decree.
And there are many. So during a recent meeting, Chicago Police Superintendent Larry Snelling, he said the study will help determine whether Chicagoans are, quote, getting enough bang for their buck. What did he mean?
Well, the Chicago Police Department's budget is set to swell to $2.1 billion in 2026. And to put that in context, that is a full third of every discretionary dollar that the city council has at its disposal. Now, Mayor Brandon Johnson has said that CPD must transform into a new kind of police department, one that focuses on the root causes of crime like poverty and mental illness, and less so on law enforcement. To do that, he says, there should be more non-sworn positions in the department. Civilians should work for CPD. And to do that, this study will say exactly what makes sense and what doesn't.
When was the last time CPD completed a workforce allocation study?
It has been 15 years, because this is one of the third rails of Chicago politics, because police deployment is a zero-sum game. You can put one officer for a certain amount of time in one part of the city. And no city council member wants to vote for something that will reduce police resources in their neck of the woods, which makes it very hard for anybody to recommend moving police officers from one part of the city to another part of the city, even though we know most of the violent crime in the city happens on the south and the west sides.
The independent monitoring team, which is, of course, the eyes and the ears of the federal judge overseeing this reform effort, they are out with their latest report on CPD's efforts to comply with the consent decree. Where do things stand now?
CPD has fully complied with 22% of the consent decree. Now, this workforce allocation study, we should have the results shortly before the consent decree celebrates its 7th birthday.
Okay. Heather Sharone, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brandis.
And you can read Heather's full story on our website. It is all at WTTW.com/news.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
The Trump administration's aggressive immigration enforcement in the city is sparking a number of legal battles. Border Patrol Chief Greg Bovino is heading to court tomorrow amid accusations of using tear gas without justification during a raid in Little Village last week. Local law enforcement is also caught in the mix as they respond to clashes between protesters and federal agents, sometimes themselves getting hurt in the process. And as the Supreme Court is set to weigh in on a potential National Guard deployment here, some worry about blurring the line between federal law enforcement and local police authority. Joining us now to discuss it all are David Franklin, Associate Professor of Law at DePaul University. Franklin currently teaches constitutional law and was a clerk to Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And on Zoom, Mitchell Davis, Chief of Police in South Suburban Hazelcrest. He has served in leadership roles with many policing organizations, including the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police, and is a member of the Illinois Law Enforcement Training and Standards Board. We also invited representatives of the Illinois State Police, Cook County Sheriff, and the Chicago Police Department to join us, but they've all declined. Gentlemen, I thank the two of you for joining us. Chief Mitchell, starting with you, so we've seen federal agents deploying tear gas on people protesting raids. Some Chicago police officers have also been exposed, like in that ICE raid that happened down the East Side neighborhood earlier this month. What do you make of some of the tactics in the operations and how they've escalated?
Well, thanks, Brandis, for having me. What's going on now, local law enforcement is getting caught in the middle of what's happening with federal agencies. We work collaboratively every day with our federal partners throughout the nation. And with the ICE enforcement that's going on now, those are federal issues. and we don't have any jurisdiction over those issues, but we're also responsible for not allowing for federal agents to be harmed by anyone, no matter how we might feel about it. So the Chicago police officers that you saw being tear gassed along with the demonstrators is an example of almost the worst case scenario, putting us in the middle of something that we have no jurisdiction over. We're not initiating anything. We're not participating. But at the same time, we get dragged into a fight that we didn't start.
And to that point, you know, I think some supporters of ICE and the administration would say that those protesters are acting aggressively themselves. They're throwing something at the agents or getting too close as the agents are trying to do their jobs. Do local police, do they have any authority or jurisdiction to challenge any of these federal operations?
No, ma'am, we do not. These are, once again, immigration is not a state issue, it's a federal issue, and they are carrying out what they've been instructed to do. And it presents challenges in that it's not collaborative in effort. That's the challenge that we have. I can't imagine any law enforcement leader that would turn down help that is properly done, but it's not being properly done. If we have immigrants or anybody that's in our community that's wreaking havoc or that's breaking the law or that's causing problems in our community, if they came to us and said, hey, Chief Davis, what's going on in your town? How can we help? And are there people in your town that we can possibly use these federal laws to get them out of the community and out of the country, however they choose to deal with it? But that's not what's going on. They're coming in, they're not collaborating with us, and it once again is putting us into the middle of something that we truly not start.
David Franklin, same question about whether local police have any authority or jurisdiction. For example, there is the court order that requires them to announce that they're about to deploy tear gas, which some of the videos would suggest they're not doing that before they're doing it. And then, therefore, police officers themselves get exposed. There's also the city's executive order that they're not supposed to use any city property. But local police can't really enforce any of those.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a general matter, constitutionally speaking. Federal officers are not limited by state law. There's a clause in the Constitution called the Supremacy Clause that says federal law is supreme over state law, and that's been interpreted for a very long time to mean that basically, with a few exceptions, the states are not allowed to limit or regulate what federal officers do. However, federal officers are still bound by federal law, including the Constitution. So there's a First Amendment that protects freedom of speech. There's a Fourth Amendment that bars the use of excessive force, and those can be the basis for court orders like the one you mentioned concerning the use of tear gas or pepper spray on peaceful protesters.
Chief Mitchell, local law enforcement agencies, as you said, you know, you all typically, when you're working with federal law enforcement partners like FBI or alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, there's some coordination. How does that coordination work?
Well, primarily, most of the times, especially in our area, but throughout the country as well, we have task forces. So the departments have people assigned to task forces, and oftentimes they're assigned to a task force full time. And then there are some task forces that it's an activation standpoint. And even if we're working on individual investigations that kind of lead into or bleed over into some of the areas that federal officers are experts at, we'll reach out to them for their assistance. And we have always, not just Hazelcrest, but all local law enforcement has always had tremendous partnerships with those federal organizations.
David Franklin, Trump administration, they are agreeing to this 30-day extension of the temporary restraining order that blocks the deployment of National Guard troops from both Illinois and Texas into the city. We're still waiting, as we mentioned, for the Supreme Court to weigh on that, as the Justice Department has requested. What is the constitutional rationale that the administration is using for this?
Well, you know, let me just say, first of all, the situation that we have here with the president ordering or trying to order troops into American cities is not normal. It's not acceptable. We have a long constitutional tradition in this country of keeping troops out of the business of domestic law enforcement. And as I mentioned, we have a First Amendment that protects peaceful protest. So the legal rationale, such as it is that there are federal statutes that authorize the president to call up and federalize state National Guards. But he has to meet certain factual thresholds before he can do that. So the president has to show, for example, that he is incapable of enforcing federal law without the presence of the National Guard. And what the district judge here in Chicago held, and what the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed, including a Trump-appointed judge and a George H.W. Bush-appointed judge, was that the president simply had not met that factual predicate. There is not a situation right now in Chicago that renders the federal officials, you know, unable or incapable of enforcing federal law.
But as this, you know, what we're seeing in the streets continues to sort of escalate, could the administration not make the case to the Supreme Court? I mean, I doubt there will be a hearing, but in their documentation and their arguments, could the Supreme Court not look at the situation and say, actually, this is difficult for federal agents to enforce?
Well, that's what I'm afraid the Supreme Court is going to do. You know, it is a problem of the Trump administration's own making, but that's their strategy, right? They want to provoke, they want to inflame, and then they want to look at that and say, see, we've got a situation here where we're incapable of enforcing federal law, or even call it a rebellion or an insurrection or an invasion. They've used all of those words, but they're all false. But I'm afraid that the Supreme Court, the very same Supreme Court that gave President Trump effectively total immunity from criminal prosecution, might well give him a blank check, you know, total deference to his factual findings as the predicate for bringing in the National Guard in a situation like this.
Chief Mitchell, what are some of the concerns with having, go ahead, with having National Guard troops on the ground?
Absolutely, and I'll go back to it again. If initially we're not sure. I know that the attorney just mentioned one means, but initially it was said that we're bringing National Guard in to get rid of crime, to help with crime. Well, once again, if someone wants to give us help, so you know, I'm the first national vice president of an organization called NOBLE, National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, and nationwide, we're not turning away help. But as once again, let's do it constructively. If you come into somebody's town. First of all, National Guard, they're not police officers. Now, they're not law enforcement trained, but if they could help us in some way, let's collaborate and do that. Hey, where do you have problem areas? Where could we use some extra bodies? And we could tell them strategically, this is where we need the assistance and this is how it can most effectively be done. Don't just send folks in without having a plan, and that puts us now behind the eight ball where we are not collaborating and we're not most effectively using the help is being provided us by the federal government.
Chief, you know, as we're looking at some of this video, right, like we're talking about the Illinois State Police, for example, are assisting in Broadview, but just region-wide, you know, you've got multiple law enforcement agencies at work here. It's State Police, Cook County Sheriff, Municipal Police, so you've got CPD in the suburbs, you've got Municipal Police there, and then you've got the deployment of all these federal agencies with or without coordination with folks on the ground. Could there be a case of too many cooks in the kitchen?
There absolutely could be. You know, let's not also forget the disruption that happens with the community trust. In local law enforcement, we work hard. We have enough challenges, but we've worked so hard to build trust within our communities. And now you have people who are coming in, they're masked, they're coming in, and oftentimes they're not identifiable as a person or agency, and they come in and they disrupt things, and then they leave us to deal with the aftermath. And you know, our national president for NOBLE has mentioned in the past that, you know, communities of color had to deal with this some time ago, but instead of coming in with masks on, they came with white hoods on, and they came in taking people. And now it's happening in a new era, and we've got to be cautious about what we're doing.
David Franklin, you know, we've got multiple jurisdictions happening here. What, same question to you, sort of, you know, what sort of complications are we talking about when trying to go about, you know, a federal deployment the way the president is attempting?
Well, I think it's clear that the president doesn't really care about law enforcement. He is switching his rationale from immigration to crime control back to immigration as the needs of the news cycle suit him. But this is a president who is a 34-time convicted felon, who doesn't seem to care about the criminal laws that are being violated by, for example, the protesters on January 6th, who he gave blanket pardons to, right? So he's perfectly content to pardon protesters who attack police. And I'm sure if it came to it, he would give pardons to police who attack protesters if the protesters opposed him. So, yes, I think the situation where you have multiple jurisdictions on the ground is a situation of chaos that's been brought to us because of the Trump administration's policy, not in spite of it.
Well, and the Trump administration, in a press release today from Department of Homeland Security, they're making the case that they have removed more than 500,000 immigrants. They're referring to them as illegal aliens, and we heard how upset Mayor Johnson got over the use of that term over the weekend. But some 527,000 deportations, including another 1.5 million people who have voluntarily self-deported. So the Trump administration is making the case that what they're doing is working and meeting the president's mandate. Governor Pritzker, and we've got 30 seconds, he has created a commission to document what he says are all of these abuses by federal immigration agents. Could this actually be useful in the future?
Oh, absolutely. I think if people are making videos, if people are pulling out their phones and documenting what's going on, all of that can be used as evidence in court and in the court of public opinion to really try to rally people around the notion that this is un-American, it's not normal, and it's not acceptable.
Okay, that's where we'll have to leave it. History still in the making, of course. David Franklin and Chief Mitchell Davis, thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, a reminder about what it means to be a sanctuary city and how that affects law enforcement. As the federal Operation Midway Blitz continues, the conflict between local laws and federal priorities have been front and center. One particular issue that has been at the forefront, Chicago's status as a so-called sanctuary city. But how exactly did Chicago become a sanctuary city, and what exactly does it mean? Our Joanna Hernandez explores the topic in tonight's edition of WTTW News Explains.
For four decades, Chicago has held the designation of a sanctuary city. But what does it mean, and how has Chicago's status endured? The term sanctuary city refers to any jurisdiction that discourages, limits, or denies cooperation with federal immigration authorities. There are currently hundreds of sanctuary communities in America and 13 sanctuary states. Where do they come from? Well, Berkeley, California claimed the title of first sanctuary city in 1971, the sanctuary city movement really began popping up across the country in the mid-1980s. As President Reagan focused on identifying and deporting undocumented immigrants, churches opened their doors to provide shelter and resources for Central Americans fleeing civil war and violence. In Chicago, becoming and remaining a sanctuary city has been a bit of a mayoral tug of war. Mayor Harold Washington first declared Chicago a sanctuary city in 1985 via executive order. The order prohibited police and city employees from questioning residents about their immigration status and terminated cooperation with federal immigration authorities. Some argued the policy shielded convicted criminals from deportation. And in the 1990s, Mayor Richard M. Daley interpreted the policy to allow city officials to provide immigration information to the feds if the subjects were involved in serious crimes. Chicago's sanctuary policies went from executive order to a strong law with the 2006 Welcoming City Ordinance. In 2012, Mayor Rahm Emanuel and the City Council weakened the law, allowing police to work with federal officials in limited cases. Upon election in 2016, President Donald Trump threatened sanctuary cities with the loss of federal dollars. Nevertheless, the Chicago City Council voted to reaffirm the ordinance. Under Mayor Lori Lightfoot, an expanded welcoming ordinance closed the loopholes opened by Daley and Emanuel, banning all police cooperation with federal immigration authorities. As Chicago enters its 40th year as a sanctuary city, Mayor Brandon Johnson has reaffirmed Chicago's commitment. And today, thousands of refugees and undocumented immigrants have found a safe haven in Chicago. A point of pride for those who believe offering sanctuary is a matter of human rights. and a point of consternation for those who see it as a hurdle for law enforcement.
And clearly things have gotten even more complicated here on the ground since we produced that video. You can find the rest of our Emmy award-winning WTTW News Explains series on our website. And that is our show for this Monday night. Be sure to sign up for our free email newsletters, The Daily Chicagoan and Urban Nature, at WTTW.com/newsletter. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Religious leaders from different faiths come together to talk about the issue of immigration enforcement. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm that gives back to the community through law and philanthropy.